But all I can say is that the kinds of stories that you read about in the Bible, they prepare you for the newspaper. Nothing in the newspaper should surprise you if you read the Bible. You're only surprised if you don't read the Bible, but if you read the Bible, yes, then you realize... What's that? Who's that? I didn't say you could predict. I just said it doesn't surprise you when it happens. Exactly the exact same questions, and they don't. And the essential point is that the passions and follies and tendencies of human beings are eternal, and you see them here, and they haven't changed. And every expectation that they will change is surprising, right? What people say, how could this possibly be? Because you're dealing with people, and this is what people are like. But anyway, and you see that clearly in the Bible, and that's one of the things that makes it more interesting is that they're not actually perfect characters, right? They're not fairy tale characters. And that's, by the way, that's even true, although a Christian might not say so, that's even true about the New Testament. The New Testament doesn't actually portray Jesus as perfect. He gets made perfect by later Christianity, but if you read the book without thinking this is a perfect person, he wouldn't strike you as a perfect person, right? He gets angry, he gets distant, he gets close, he says things that contradict each other, there's stories that aren't the same, all those sorts of things. In that sense, the tradition of genuine storytelling carries on. But it makes us human, but it doesn't make us, it's a misuse of the word perfect to say imperfection makes you perfect. It may make you whole, but it doesn't make you perfect, right? Otherwise, perfect has no meaning. Perfect has to mean without flaw, and we're not. We're fully flawed. Yes, well, you know, that's true to some extent, but I would say that it depends on how flawed you are, right? Flaws sometimes cease to be boring and become terrible, depending on how flawed. But it's certainly true that that the characters here, as the characters in the newspaper, are neither perfect nor boring. What's that? I didn't mention any specific story. I just yes, exactly. That's right. Well, okay. So, let's see. Where do we stop? We stopped, I think, at the blessing itself. And if we didn't, we can reread it, which is chapter 27, verse 28, right? Or even 26. His father Isaac said to him, "Come close and kiss me, my son." And he went up and kissed him. And once again, does he want to kiss him just because he wants a kiss, or does he want to kiss him because he's testing to see if this is in fact Esau? And if it is, then does he really deceive him? We don't know for sure, right? Maybe he kisses him and he goes, "Ah, it's Isaac, so this is in fact the right person that I'm supposed to be blessing." Or maybe he... Right, there's a smell if they have drugs. Exactly, it's the same sort of thing. Here, now I just want to give you a kiss. I just want to give you a kiss. And while I'm at it, turn out your pockets. What's that?
Is that why we kiss our kids?
Right. Depends at what age. Right, not at age 5, but at age 16, it could be. Yeah, at 3 in the morning, right, exactly. The 3 in the morning kiss is an exploratory kiss. Which, by the way, it's interesting that you should say that, because later on in the story, you know, Esau and Jacob will kiss. And above the word kiss, there are several dots in the Torah, which are unexplained. And the rabbis say that what Esau did was not kiss him, but bite him. Like, let him know this hostility may overtly be done, but it's not really done. Now, you can read the dots another way, but that's how the rabbis read it, because you know they're not sympathetic to Esau anyway. But there are kisses that are for other intent. You know, so, I mean, just watch a Godfather movie, and the kiss is right. The kiss is, you know, the horse head in the morning. This kiss, it says clearly. He says, and he smelled his clothes, and he blessed him, saying, The smell of my son is like the smell of the fields that the Lord has blessed. Now, here too, this is kind of an ambiguous phrase, because the truth is that the fields are what God has blessed. And you would think that, in fact, Isaac would be searching for, remember, he's promised the land. That's what he's promised. And to some extent, Esau represents the land, even more than Isaac does, right? He represents literally the earth, the land. And so when Isaac smells the land on him, he thinks this is the person to bless. I mean, that's how it seems to me anyway. He says, and there is, you could make actually a good sermon out of the idea that Jacob, who is not natural to the land, right? Esau is, but Jacob isn't. Jacob is, you know, we talked about that last time, somebody who studies. Jacob, who's not natural to the land, has to inherit the land and make something of it. And this could be a very nice analogy with the Zionism, because all these Zionists came from Eastern Europe. They never held a plow in their lives, right? Bialik talks about how there was one generic word for tree in Yiddish, because where they lived, nobody paid attention to trees. You didn't have a maple and a pine. And I mean, there are more names for trees in Beverly Hills streets than there are in the whole Yiddish language, because there was a tree. And yet, these people somehow transformed themselves into agricultural experts. And that's what Jacob has to do. He has to grow into the land, as opposed to being somebody who takes to the land naturally. And you see this, by the way, I mean, I'm seeing it now. My niece is in Israel, and she's sending back, you know, periodic long dispatches, as children tend to do, assuming that their whole family will be interested in everywhere they went and everything they did. And we all dutifully read most of it. But you can see the transformation of a kid who actually spends some time on a kibbutz to be exposed when she grew up in Philadelphia, right? Who actually is exposed to a land, and to the idea of a land, and to the birth of a calf, and all those things. Anyway, so she says, Isaac says, "May God give you of the dew of the heaven and the fat of the earth, abundance of new grain and wine. Let people serve you and nations bow down to you. Be master over your brothers, and let your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be they who curse you, blessed they who bless you." So we're going to look at it in more detail later, but let's at least take some time to notice, first of all, that this is, does not seem to be the allocation of Isaac's resources. He doesn't say, you know, and you get my land. Rather, he invokes God's blessing on Jacob. And part of God's blessing is priority in the family, right? It's not just you can have my stuff. In fact, it's not at all you can have my stuff. But it is that your brothers will be subordinate to you. And they'll have to serve you. And not only will they have to serve you, but I always found this interesting, that what's the reaction of brothers who have to serve another brother?
Resentment,
which is why the next line comes. Cursed be they who curse you, blessed be they who bless you, which not only says your brothers will serve you, but they can't resent it, because if they resent it, they're going to get cursed. It's a very, you know, if you're Esav, you've really been boxed in here, right? You can't, you serve your brother and you can't curse your brother.
Why the six brothers? He only has one brother.
It says, B'nei Imecha, literally, the children of your mother's womb, or the children of your mother. V'yishtachavu lecha b'nei Imecha, the children of your mother will bow down to you. It's there. I'll give you three possible answers to that question, and which is the correct answer, I think nobody can know. One, this was already a preset verbal formula that was put into this story. That's what modern critics might say. Two, it's a typical blessing, and you don't change it. Just like when I bless my daughter, I bless her Yivarechecha Adonai v'Yishmerecha, even though that's the male form, because that's the biblical blessing. And three is that she had other children that we don't know of. Any of those three are possible. So, but...
Is
Well, it could mean that you serve yourself, I suppose, although it seems to be establishing priority, but yeah.
Is this the same wording that is used when Joseph reveals his dream about his brothers
bowing down to him? I have to take a look. And this is, let's see what he says. He says, I mean, the word yishtachaveh has got to be the same because that's the only word for bowed down. Asar kochavim mishtachavim li. So, yes. And where's the previous one? The previous one is, he had a dream and they hated him even more. Tishtachavena la'alumati. So both times it uses the word bow down, but that's just because it's the word bow down. I don't know if it's supposed to be. Yeah, I don't know if it's supposed to be a connection or not. But it certainly presages. It certainly presages it. It's possible, but also all those things are possible. But I don't want to lose the immediate context of this, which is Jacob gets priority over Esau. I mean, that's the engine that drives the story here. No sooner had Jacob left the presence of his father Isaac, after Isaac had finished blessing Jacob, than his brother Esau came back from his hunt. Now, why does Esau come back the minute Jacob leaves? I think because if you're staging a play, right? I mean, it's the dramatic moment. No sooner has Jacob left the room than in comes Esau, all ready for the blessing, right? I mean, that's exactly how it would have to be. If it said, and 3 days later, Esau comes, you know, wandering in with his game, but it's as soon as Jacob leaves. So he too prepared a dish and brought it to his father. And he said to his father, and by the way, I have this mental image, although it may not be true, of this, that this is how Rebekah can delay Esau. Because the truth is, she can't control how long it takes Esau to hunt an animal. But if he has to come home and prepare the dish, and she knows Isaac's still in there with Jacob, I could see her saying, you know, I think a little more turmeric would give that just the kick he likes. So... I don't know. I mean, it says nothing about it, but the fact that he comes in just when Jacob is done, just from what we already know of the story, my guess is somehow Rebecca had a hand in this. So he said to his father, "Let my father sit up and eat of his son's game, so that you may give me your innermost blessing." Now, he changes from the impersonal to the personal, of his son's game, so that you may give me your blessing. He's describing what already happened, of course, right? He already ate of his son's game, but also Esau may be expressing his image of himself, that he's Isaac's son, right? It doesn't say one of your sons, but it's your son's game, and then give me your blessing. Isaac said to him, "Who are you?" And he said, "I'm Esau, your firstborn." Now, in my translation, there's an exclamation point. "I'm Esau, your firstborn," right? But remember that the Hebrew has no punctuation. So every bit of punctuation is telling you how you're supposed to read this. But you can read it lots of ways, right? He could be shocked, he could be surprised, it could be every day, you know, maybe Isaac isn't always clear and he's just explaining patiently to him. Anyway, but as soon as Isaac hears this, it sounds like he knows what's going on, right? He was seized with a very violent trembling. And that is exactly how there's almost no way to express the Hebrew in the English. It says Vayecherad, which means he was trembling. Yitzchak, Isaac. Vayecherad Yitzchak. Charada, a trembling, like charedim, the Hebrew word for ultra-Orthodox in Israel. Charedim means tremblers, those who tremble before God. Vayecherad Yitzchak charada gedola, a great trembling, ad ma'od, until very much. So in other words, he was really totally thrown for a loop, right? That uses 5 words to express the degree, the extent of his trembling. Because now this is, I think, probably the biggest argument against the idea that he knew what he was doing, right? Because if he knew what he was doing, then this all has to be an act that he's trembling like this. And he's completely, you know that feeling that seizes you when all of a sudden you realize you either didn't do something you were supposed to do that was really important, or you did something that you weren't supposed to do. Like the person calls you and says, oh, I just wanted to call you back to tell you, you must not tell that to anyone, right? After you sent out the email that lets everybody know, you know, Janie is pregnant, you know, and they call back and say, you must not tell anybody about this. I'll never forgive you. So that sense where your stomach drops out and you're just horrified that you have done this and you can't turn back the clock, that's what Isaac must be feeling, right? Yeah.
It just struck me. I agree. I always felt that that was so clear. Therefore, he didn't know. And again, this ambiguity that I see in the story, this duality, you know, the hairy hands and this beautiful face. And Isaac himself is not really finished. He's not yet a saint. He's trying to do God's will. He thinks he's doing God's will. He's sort of blindly following God's will. He doesn't really analyze. He doesn't really look inside. He doesn't really grapple with things. And now he realizes, oh man, I didn't follow God's will. I was following my own blindness.
So if you think of Isaac as having his whole life been weighted down by the responsibility of being the carrier of God's word, and here he blew it, then it's really, that's okay, the mic didn't pick that up. Then it's really a horrendously terrible, yeah.
I think that's why there's 5 words.
Right, to let you know, which is the Bible's way of putting exclamation points in front of it, yeah, behind it.
I had a great deal of difficulty with this as I keep reading it, and I try to put the story aside. I don't understand how a blessing made of deceit, and then the deceit is learned, cannot be obviated. Why the first blessing remains in effect, and a second or inferior blessing has to be given when the first one is clearly based on fraud, deceit. It defies justice, as we know justice in the Western world, and it defies logic, as we know in the country.
Well, the reason that it doesn't in the biblical world is, if you believe that a blessing does something, then you would say, if I punch you, how come I can't take it back? Because it's done. The doing is done. And the only way you can take a blessing back is if you think it doesn't do something. But in the ancient world, when you bless somebody, you have done it. No less than if you hit someone. So you can't say, oh, forget it, I didn't mean to bless you. You've blessed him. You can't say, I didn't mean to hit you. You've hit him. It's done. That analogy, the force of words in the ancient world is so taken so seriously, when you say something, you can't take it back. Which is why, for example, over and over again, you will see what is called in Hebrew, Lashon Sagi Nahor, which means the language of sufficient light. You don't say someone is blind. You say the opposite. They have sufficient light. And by saying they have sufficient light, you really mean they're blind. So when, for example, a biblical commentator will talk about wiping out Israel, that God, you know, wanted to wipe out Israel, they'll never write, God wanted to wipe out Israel. They'll always write, God wished to wipe out the enemies of Israel. The exact opposite. And reading it in context, you understand what they're saying. Because words were not felt to be empty or that they didn't have an effect in the world. That's what blessings are all about, right? A blessing does something, and once you've blessed, the person's blessed.
Then, if I may, one follow-up. If we take that notion of the ancient world and how it's, and your explanation, I have to agree with it, I can't dispute it. Then what lesson do we take 3,000 years later? What our concept of
Be careful what you say.
But as you say, if you
but it's still true. But it's still true. What you say now also has endless effects.
But a contract in America, an Anglo-American law, you cannot build a contract out of fraud.
That may be an illegal system, but we're not talking about a legal system here. We're talking about a father's blessing to his child. And that can't be taken back. If your child said, if a father says to his child, your younger brother will serve you, or your older brother will serve you, right, and you will be blessed. Later on, if he comes back and says, oh, no, I was mistaken, that doesn't erase what he said. It doesn't.
But your storytelling, but your storytelling was very poignant because he said, when does Esau show up? Immediately.
Right.
It isn't a week or two or a month later.
Doesn't matter, but it's been done. It's been done. Anybody here who has ever said something powerful to their child knows you can't erase it. You can't. Stays with the child forever. Doesn't matter what you say afterwards. Yeah.
I was just going to say, the words are important because the child hears it, but if his intention was to bless Esau, his true intention...
He does bless him. He does bless him.
How does the blessing take?
He does bless him, but he can't bless him with the same thing he already blessed Isaac with, because that blessing is already taken, right? You really do have this stock of blessings, and when you give one out, you can't forget it and give another one, which is why, by the way, it is against Jewish law to make something called a bracha levatala, which means a blessing for no reason. You're not allowed to, because blessings really matter. Right? A bracha levatala means, in other words, if I, right now, I'm not allowed, according to Jewish law, to make the motzi and then just keep talking. That's a bracha levatala. It's for no reason. It's batel. So, yes. But also good things, because they're intertwined. Well, remember, but it's not just, I don't want to exaggerate, because it's also good things in the sense that, for example, Sarah was not involved in the Akedah. Rivka was the one who came to Isaac and comforted him over the loss of his mother. She's the one, it's true that it's by way of a bad thing, but she's the one who enables Jacob to have the blessing that he should have. So the point is, it's mixed.
Yeah.
But also, what they do is mixed. What they do is morally mixed, but what men do is morally mixed too, right? Well, I just read the other, I want to tell you two things. First of all, a brand new woman's Torah commentary came out, a full commentary only about women and by women from the Reform movement. And I'll get a copy and we'll take a look at what some of it has. But the other thing is, in reading about the events of the past few days, someone, and I don't remember where I read it, someone said that their father had told them, and I don't remember if it was a man or a woman, their father told them that the two most powerful people in the world were old white men and pretty young women. Yeah. Now, that idea, and the idea of the Bible, is that men and women wield power differently in the world, but they both wield power. And which is a better position to be in depends on a lot of things. It's not so cut and dried. My guess is right now, in the current scandal in the paper, the pretty young woman will come out of it much better than the old white man. Right? That's my guess. I don't know for sure, but that's my guess. So it's not easy to figure out. Yeah.
At least I relate to that as a human being, that those moments of deep awakening that we try to deny the reality, we try to comply, all those defense mechanisms that we use, and there are moments of deep, deep awakening, like the knife really strikes the bone. And I wonder if that emphasis on trembling is that deep awakening of Esau when he was on the with the accident, when he couldn't feel or demonstrate his trembling. When
maybe it may be a long, the culmination of a long sequence of events in his life. Yeah.
This is very disturbing. Two things. Number one, the extreme differentiation between children in all the forefathers that we distinguish between kids. And it seems that the blessing should be okay, fine, good for you, the older one gets a blessing. But it turns out the blessing for the older one is actually a curse for the younger one. So this
Yes.
Balance.
Well, it's not. It's actually not necessarily a curse. It depends what mother sons bow down to you. The only curse is curse those who curse you. It's only a curse for the younger one if he curses the older one, right?
No, but if you are becoming a servant, I mean that's what it's saying. Okay, so now the younger ones,
right.
You become servants. I mean that's what it's saying.
Yeah. Okay, well, I would say this. If you have a very small society, it's the reality, right? That some people will be on top and others will correspondingly be on the bottom. That's just the truth. So, yes, what's that? The nature of human beings and the way the world works. Show me any group where everybody is exactly equal.
Well, the smaller unit is a family. And then you
show me a family where everybody's equal.
And if you want to, you know, establish that rule that one has to serve the other, the family will fail. But if you establish that rule that you both should serve each other.
But he's not talking about around the dinner table. He's talking about in the world. I think that the biblical view is that in fact there has to be some kind of hierarchy or society doesn't work. Yeah.
In most clannish mammals, there's an alpha male.
Right. Just like in.
The
yep. Just like among monkeys, and there is, and you know what? It's true. We don't like to say it, and we don't like to admit it. But actually, there was just something this morning, and I didn't read the article. But the title of the article was, "Even when anarchists get together, they pick who's going to run the meeting," you know? So it just, these are, and I would say this is one of those cases where the Bible's uncomfortable realities tend to override our ideals, which is every group has a leader, every family has people that are more and less successful who call the shots, who don't call the shots. Younger brothers sometimes take the role of older brothers, but, you know, it's clear in most families when the family has to make a decision, it's very hard to have everybody have an equal voice. It's just very hard. And in many families, impossible. And I would say with Jacob and Esau, with two such different natures, you have to say, is the family going to go in the direction of Jacob, or is it going to go in the direction of Esau? So anyway, but we'll come back to it. We will come back to it. Who was it then, he demanded, that hunted game and brought it to me? Moreover, I ate of it before you came, and I blessed him. Now he must remain blessed. So, do you know what this reminds me of, since we're coming up on Purim? If you remember at the end of the Purim story, Ahasuerus sends a decree that the Jews can be killed, right? And then he can't rescind the decree. All he can do is send another decree that the Jews can fight their enemies, right? And so he sends a second decree, and the Jews win the war against their enemies, but he doesn't say, oh, well, I'll just call back the first decree. And there is something, I guess, about the traditional conception of words that once they're sealed, they're sealed, and there's nothing you can do about it. Anyway, so when Esau heard his father's words, he burst into wild and bitter sobbing. And again, tsa'ak, vayitz'ak, tsa'aka, Gidola Umara Admaod, the same thing as the violent trembling. And maybe, for those of you who are looking for these parallelisms, maybe this says something about the emotional nature of Isaac and Esau. You know, we always think of Isaac as calm, but maybe Isaac was a hysteric, and so was Esau. Maybe he wasn't a hysteric before his father bound him and held a knife above his neck, but after that, he got a little hysterical. But I mean, there is a parallel emotional, in the words too, a parallel emotional reaction about what Isaac goes through and what Esau goes through. But on the other hand, you can also just say, this is an extraordinarily emotional scene, right? And the Bible is using the words that explain it. Vayomer la'aviv, and he says to his father, and these are heart-rending words. He says, Berachini gam ani, avi, bless me too, my father. Which, I mean, how can you not feel for Esau here? You know, he says, bless me too. I feel, you know, bereft that my brother got a blessing and I didn't get a blessing. And he says, Vayomer, which is really, and he answered. They say, but he answered. Your brother came with guile and took away your blessing. So now the whole scheme has been revealed. Trickery. Esau said, was he then named Jacob that he might supplant me these two times? Vayakveni, Yaakov. And Yaakov, one of the means of Yaakov is supplant. First he took away my birthright, and now he's taken away my blessing. So, well, that's the question. Remember that we've dealt with a couple times whether the birthright and the blessing are identical. One, it seems, is the family property, and the other, it seems, is the general blessing to the world. Although, as we saw last time, Ramban has a different idea of it. Some people think it's the same, some different. But one of the things that this allows, whatever the differences are between birthright and blessing, it allows us to say that Jacob's deception was really a deception. Because if what he got wasn't the birthright that Esau sold before, then he was stealing something else. You could make the case for Jacob, if what he stole was the birthright, you could make the case that he had to steal the birthright, because even though he bought it legitimately for that the lentils before, even though he bought it, nobody was acknowledging his sale, so he had to steal it now. But Esau, in the midst of the stealing, is saying, he got my birthright already. I know I sold it to him back then. Does he have to also take my blessing? Yeah.
Isaac stuns me again. Like, instead of saying I go through oops, you know, taking responsibility for giving the blessing, he said he tricked me. It's again pointing the finger at.
But he did. Well, he did trick him.
He had some.
But still, you could. But he still, when someone tricks you, what do you say?
You're tricking.
He tricked me.
No, I would say I was tricked.
Either way, okay, but. But the whole focus is who did it, right? He wants to know who did it. You can say I was tricked, but I don't think it's, I'm not sure that it's indicative of anything other than a normal reaction to say, oh my God, he tricked me. Yeah, one second.
What does the birthright look like?
It doesn't have a physical form.
So right. He says he took my birthright for a thing of lentils.
How? That means the division of property. Presumably the division of property. He gets more property.
A verbal agreement.
Right.
It's not anything physical that you could...
No, but a verbal agreement, you know, as Sam Goldman said, isn't worth the paper it's written on. No, but a verbal agreement is what decides who gets the property. So
but it was simply verbal. There was nothing physical or...
Not that it mentions.
Okay.
No. In Jewish law, maybe, but here it's giving a very literalistic reading of once you give the blessing, you give the blessing. So, and I don't know in modern Jewish law if you give a blessing by mistake, if you could actually recall it. I don't know the answer to that. It partly depends what the blessing entails. If it's a division of property, that might be one thing. But if it's a blessing for prosperity in the world that you meant to give to someone else, My guess would be that you can't claim, if a person is right in front of you and you bless them, you have a very hard time saying, oh, I didn't mean to bless him.
Even though the words that you said were directed to...
Even though in your mind you were thinking about someone else. Here's what I would guess, not having investigated this, and I'll have to ask somebody who knows more about it than I do. But, you know, it might be the same thing as the controversy that swirled through the church in the Middle Ages and what they decided. There was a big controversy in the church in the Middle Ages whether a priest who was giving the sacraments, who either before or after was proved to be in some way unworthy of being a priest, does that sacrament still count? And this was a big debate, for hundreds of years in the Middle Ages, and the eventual decision was the only decision they could come to, which is it counts, because the priest is actually not the person giving the blessing. The blessing is coming through God, and even if the vessel God's using is imperfect, once the church says, if it's a bad priest, it's a bad blessing, the church loses all authority, because you can always say the priest was a bad priest, and it doesn't count. So here too, I wonder if the blessing you might be able to change if you think of the person as the one who decides the blessing. But if they're invoking God's blessing on this person in front of them and then later says, oh, I didn't mean to, probably it still counts. Probably. But I don't know for sure. Yeah. Yes.
It was a blessing for marriage.
Right.
Excellent
point.
But a blessing for marriage.
Excellent point. Excellent point. Okay, one second. Let me just finish this section. So, and he added, have you not reserved the blessing for me? Isaac answered, saying to Esau, but I've made him master over you. I've given him all his brothers for servants. Again, plural of brothers, which makes you think there must have been other toddlers running around the house, and sustained him with grain and wine. What then can I still do for you, my son? And Esau said to his father, have you but one blessing, father? Bless me too, father. And Esau wept aloud. And I think this also, this is a beautiful comment because Esau is letting his father know that he has more blessings than he thinks he does. Which for parents, you know, one of the weird things about being a parent is that you don't actually feel your own power because you're not used to being anointed parent, right? And so sometimes your children will react to something you said and you'll be astonished by how seriously they take it, right? Because it's just you, right? But you're a parent. And so Isaac is so shaken by this whole thing, he thinks there's nothing he can do. But Esau is saying, you know, you have more than one blessing, and what you say to me matters to me, so bless me too. And Isaac does, and he gives him a nice blessing. See, your abode shall enjoy the fat of the earth and the dew of the heaven above. Yet by your sword shall you live, and you shall serve your brother, but when you grow restive, you shall break his yoke from your neck. So what he did was he extended it beyond. It's true you're going to serve your brother, but I never said forever. And the time will come that you will be on your own. That you'll be on your own. And one way of interpreting this, though hardly the only way, is that Jacob's anger and jealousy at what, Esau's anger and jealousy at what Jacob did was his way of serving his brother. He was enthralled to his brother by being angry and jealous. And when they reconciled, he broke the yoke from his neck. It's possible. Okay, now let's stop there in terms of the reading and take questions and comments on yes, go ahead.
The blessing to Jacob doesn't seem to have a time limit on it.
No, it doesn't seem to.
No.
But it doesn't say he'll serve you forever, so maybe that's the, right. It says, be master over your brothers and let your mother's sons bow down to you, and it's still conceivable that he could say, but I don't mean forever. It's conceivable, right? So, yeah.
Go back to that point that I made about Esau's character, that I think it has repercussions as parents, how strong you are to take the blame on yourself. It has repercussions for sibling relationship, that if Esau was a stronger father or husband and would have taken responsibility for his role, maybe the animosity between Jacob and Esau would have been much less intense.
Maybe. Okay. Yeah.
When Isaac gave the blessing, is there any significance in saying let your mother's sons die to you, or that's just...
I think it's just a phrase. I'm trying to think what it could mean. I mean, mother sons is a common phrase, but I don't know if it has any special significance here.
Rabbi,
I don't know.
In the old Chumash, the Hertz.
Yeah. What does he say?
Descendants.
Right, but the Hebrew is mother sons, so he's just being generic. But the Hebrew is mother sons. I don't know, but as you can see, I mean, Esau is an incredibly sympathetic figure here, right? If you didn't know that you're supposed to dislike him, there'd be no reason to dislike him, right? And then it goes on to say, now Esau harbored a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing which his father had given him. And Esau said to himself, let but the mourning period of my father come, and I will kill my brother Jacob. Now there he's a little less sympathetic.
So he's not dying?
So no, he doesn't die yet. It says, let the mourning period of my father come. In other words, when he dies. When the words of her older son Esau were reported to Rebekah, I guess she wasn't listening in. Someone had to tell her. But again, does Rebekah have a network of spies around the house? Apparently so, right? Because you can imagine the servants are loyal to her. She sent for her younger brother Jacob and said to him, your brother Esau is consoling himself by planning to kill you. Now, my son, listen to me. Flee at once to Haran, to my brother Lavan. Stay with him a while till your brother's fury subsides, until your brother's anger against you subsides, till he forgets what you have done to him.
No.
Mm-hmm. Then I'll fetch you from there. Let me not lose you both in one day. Okay, so then I'm going to stop there, but then he goes off, obviously, and she schemes about how he should go to Haran and get a wife, but also notice that she has shifted responsibility from herself now to Jacob. And there's a certain, and it lets us know retroactively, there's a certain unreality to her having told him, don't worry, the sin will be on me. Because no one was, I mean, Esau wasn't going to kill her. Esau was going to kill Jacob. Yeah.
Right, I understand earlier you said there's no punctuation in the Torah.
Right.
So that in the blessing that Isaac gives to Esau, the periods that we have, the semicolons
right.
that we are seeing in English do not exist.
Right. So the only time, if you look at the Torah scroll as it is now, it's the Masoretes who created the Torah scroll, the only punctuation you will see are line divisions and spaces between words, right? So for example, for a blessing of three lines, you'll see each of the lines written by itself. The Ten Commandments each has a space between them. But other than that, there's no punctuation. And in fact, in the oldest manuscripts, like if you look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, you'll see that there's no space sometimes even between the words, much of the time. So at a certain point, the Masoretes created what's called the Masoretic Text. And that was in the 7th to 8th century. In other words, a long time after the Torah was first written, they decided on the spaces between the words, the spaces between the lines, the spaces between the paragraphs, and they decided out of like several different versions. It was not just one text. That's why you had a Masoretic tradition. They had to get together all these different words, punctuation, so on from the Torah, and put it together and try to decide what it is, what is the authentic version.
Who were these people?
Masoretes. Masoretic. They were a group of Jewish scholars, right, who lived in the, 800s, 900s, a little earlier, 700s. If you look up, you can look it up in the Jewish Encyclopedia, but you can look it up on Wikipedia too. Just look up Masoretic Text, MT it's referred to, and that's the text that we use of the Torah, but it's not the only one. When we went to rabbinical school, they gave us this big book, brought this big book called Biblica Hebraica Stuttgart, which gives you the Torah text, and at the bottom, all the versions, because we have no two existing texts of the Torah that exactly match each other, right? I mean, from the 10th century, which are our earliest texts. So there are always variations, which is what you would expect if you had different copyists and Torahs went to different parts of the world and different traditions and so on. And, you know, anyway.
You said that before about the 10th century. Mm-hmm. What went on between the 7th and 10th centuries?
We just don't have any remaining manuscripts. The first manuscripts are from the 10th century. Yeah. Except for the Dead Sea Scrolls, which is why the Dead Sea Scrolls are so important.
And when are they from?
They're from the 2nd century CE, from about 800 years before the next earliest, which is called the Leningrad Codex, which is the next earliest copy of the Torah that we have.
And Leningrad is?
10th century.
So you're saying that the Torahs that are in the Ark are all identical?
But that was a process of a development.
But they're not necessarily what came, they're not like the Dead Sea Scrolls?
They have differences with the Dead Sea Scrolls. Most of the differences are minor, but some of the differences of other manuscripts from that you see in the BHS are slightly more major. I mean, none of them say, you know, Abraham married, you know,
okay.
Right, Potiphar's wife. But okay, thank you.